This is Nick, and I'm whispering because the baby is napping. However, I realize my normal theme isn't dramatic enough, so how about this? Much better. So, as alluded to last time, we're doing a movie in response to an upcoming attraction. This particular one I watched with my buddy and regular panelist Jeremy on the big screen in IMAX. The Final Cut Edition is the one we're doing, and my god, is it beautiful. So, normal stuff. If you're listening to this now, tonight is Devil Dog with Cineprov. I'll do an intro riff on a short, but hopefully you'll see me soon if you can't come tonight. Additionally, join the Facebook page and please give us a 5-star review on iTunes because we need them. We haven't gotten many in the last year and I'm feeling so lonesome. But other than that, guys, please enjoy the Harrison Ford and Ridley Scott classic. Blade Runner.
Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Cornflake.
So we host the Flopcast.
We cover nerd and geek subjects of all types, but this is sort of a sillier, goofier side of geekdom, I'd say.
We love to talk about music, especially funny music.
We talk about comic books, conventions.
Saturday morning cartoons!
Oh, yeah. I'd say if you're going to put the Flopcast in Brady Bunch terms, we're like the Cousin Oliver of podcasting. And we do a ridiculous new Flopcast episode every week.
What is wrong with us?
We really have nothing else to do. We're part of the Earth Station One podcast network.
And you can find us at flopcast.net.
Welcome to Myopia Defend Your Childhood. This week we watch 1982's Blade Runner. I got no jokes here. This movie's too good. Other than it's worth watching because Ryan Gosling gets punched in the face in the sequel. I'm Nick Hoffman, editor-in-chief of Dude Letters, member of Cineprov, and host of Myopia Defend Your Childhood. And on the panel this week we have...
Jeremy.
Matthew W. Quinn.
Hello, this is Daniel, and I'm stranded on Earth because I didn't pass the IQ test.
I'm Scott.
That was a reference to the novel.
It was.
Well, just before we start off, in reference to not having a joke, the crew members called the movie Blade Runner because it was such a troubled production.
Oh, is this where they all also wore T-shirts that said Ridley, Will Rogers never met with Ridley Scott?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The old joke being Will Rogers never met someone he didn't like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this we should talk a little bit about what this movie is, who it's doing what to, I don't know. So for, I guess, point of reference, we actually watched the 2007, yes, that makes it also a decade old, Final Cut edition.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
The Final Cut.
Jeez.
Well, and let it be known, I'm probably the only person at this table who was born when the original came out.
True.
82, yeah.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Did you ever see the theatrical version?
I did on a Flipper DVD.
Oh, nice. Yes. Nice. Oh, when Flipper the Director's DVD. Cut came out. Yeah.
Yeah, Director's Cut came out maybe 10 years after.
Yeah, 92. And then, like, when they were first releasing DVDs, this is like one of the first 10 DVDs they ever released was Blade Runner.
I had one of those, like, 5-disc box set versions and lent it out somewhere. I don't know where it is. So now I just have the 1-disc Final Cut with the 1 version.
Welcome to my world. I had a really nice Star Wars character guide I lent out to a friend. He loaned it to someone else and then lost it.
Friends are terrible.
This is why. I very, very rarely lend things out.
Yeah, me too.
That's why I just forget what I lend to people. So I'm never upset about it.
Not going to lie, I totally have a note on my computer that says what I've let out to people. So
that's what we're talking
about me.
That's what we're talking about this week is lending things out to friends.
Now,
pros and cons.
When they don't return it promptly, that obviously means they're a replicant, and then he has to hire a Blade Runner to go and hunt them down.
Retire them.
My joke was going to be, then he has to get a replicant. Anyway, and you said, how did you first watch the Final Cut? Was this your story?
Oh, yes. As mentioned to Nick earlier, the first time I saw the Final Cut was on HD DVD. Remember those?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, this was when it was pretty much determined that Blu-ray was going to be the dominant format, so people were getting rid of all their HD DVD stock. So a friend of mine purchased a player and a couple of movies for $100.
Hmm.
Perfect.
All right.
Hell. All right. So what we should do is kind of talk about this. Daniel, you want to try to give a plot synopsis?
Yeah, it's actually a really straightforward plot. There's a guy in the future. It's 2021. No, it's 2019. Excuse me. Where he works as a Blade Runner. Those are people that kill replicants. And replicants are these artificial humans that were created to do menial labor on Mars. Some of them sometimes escape and make it to Earth. And in this movie, four of them are on Mars trying to find a way to extend their lifespan. So Deckard has to find them and kill them before they find a way to do that.
Yeah. These are, I think, Revision 6 or whatever they call it.
Yeah, Nexus 6. Nexus 6.
All of you, thank you.
Nexus 6.
Bring it up sexy on the ones and twos.
More human than human is our motto.
And the Tyrell Corp makes them. And as you said, they're given a four-year lifespan. They're trying to extend it. Very simple plot device. Yeah. It's a race against time. And then, Jeremy and I were talking about this. Harrison Ford is incredible here. And this movie was a huge bomb because people were expecting to see a Star Wars or an Indiana Jones movie, and they were sorely mistaken.
It got released the same day as The Thing. John Carpenter's The Thing.
Didn't The Thing bomb too?
It did.
Wow, bad weekend.
Hey, that means in the same 6 weeks we've done two movies that were both failures. Our podcast is
really pick only the best.
Well, to be fair, it's also because E.T. was around at the time and everybody was going to see E.T.
That's fair.
Because all
fair.
The families were going, what do we see, E.T. or Blade Runner?
When we get to Army of Darkness, there's a story behind that that relates.
Well, I want to bring up... we should talk about, like, who saw this movie, because apparently if it was a bomb, it was only directors in the audience, right? Because this is like Seven. This is everything done by, like, yeah. This movie must be the most ripped off movie that no one saw at the time.
Well, time for me to be kind of offensive. I thought the middle third of it, like when after Rachel leaves his apartment before he gets beat up by a stripper, I thought that was really boring.
There is a little lag to it.
Part where Rachel shows up and he talks about how her memories were implanted?
After that, when he's the whole thing where he's just sitting there looking at his little camera and scanning around for so long.
Enhanced scales.
I mean, I just thought it was boring.
I will give you that it's not action-packed, but that's the William Friedkin version. Like, that's him actually doing his cop work. Like, that's him actually figuring out the stuff. Like, he sees the woman beaten unconscious and missing scales.
Yeah, detective work is boring, but it doesn't always have to be boring on screen.
It's kind of a tribute to those old 40s noirs where the detective is just in his office with a scotch and looking over photos of dames.
At the time, like, enhancing and zooming in on a photo and stuff, it was supposed to be, let's show off this crazy technology.
Yeah, putting this in the context of 1982, this was mind-blowing.
Yeah. Good point. It'd still be good today, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to complain. I mean, and it does remind me of a scene of, like, French Connection or Chinatown. I was making sure my dates were right, and they are good. But I mean, because this is, I mean, you watch Seven is the movie I kept going back to because it's always raining, it's always nighttime for some reason. Even when they're inside and it's daytime, it's bleak.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the book, that's because this is a post-nuclear war and there's actually, like, radioactive dust that's going around and slowly killing everyone.
I will say I am grateful for the fact that it's not laden with exposition.
Yeah, there's a gentleman I know named Bruno Lombardi wrote a scenario where the idea is that this is in the aftermath of a comet winter. That's why it's raining. That's why Los Angeles is Seattle, because the rain is coming down for years.
I just thought LA is so smoggy and polluted that in 37 years it would be just a total nightmare there.
But that's 100% what I got, because, like, when they do the pan over at the beginning, it's all smoke and fire coming out of, like,
more pollution.
Gas burning off the oil refineries.
Yeah.
The rain, though, it's always raining for some reason.
All that neon just wouldn't look as good during the day.
Oh, no, yeah. I agree. And the and laughing.
And all the practical miniature effects are so much easier to do at night.
Well, and the laughing woman dressed up in kabuki makeup and the geisha, like, my God. God, everywhere. Like that emanating through the shades.
How do they do this, by the way? How do they do anything that happens in the first 45 seconds of this movie?
I have no idea.
And then throughout the movie.
Fusion power, maybe? That's how you can maybe have flying cars.
We're talking about the movie.
Filming the movie. I mean, I know they made like a miniature to scale version of the city and kind of flew over it with a crane.
Yeah, that's exactly what they did.
Flying cars,
some of it was post-production.
Look a little CGI.
100% not.
Nothing's computer.
Yeah. That's all practical.
Yeah, 1982. There was no CGI. Wires.
Remember the whole conversation about Last Starfighter, where it's all. Where it looked, where it's all old school CGI, like the oldest CGI. I thought those cars looked like the very oldest CGI.
Well, the part of the issue is originally, not in the final cut, but originally you could see the wires that were attached to those cars, and it drove Ridley Scott nuts.
That's part of the final cut, is that they went in there and got rid of those digitally.
So what we should do, I guess, because I think for the most part it's a kind of loving on this movie, this one held up surprisingly well. And actually, it's one of the few movies we've done that I enjoyed more as an adult than I did as a kid.
Well, actually, can I get into my whole experience with this?
Please.
I was one of those geeks that read the novel before I saw the movie, and the novel's fantastic. But so I was really excited to see the movie for the first time, and when I saw it, I'm like, they cut everything out. There's like two other replicants, or Andes in the novel. They're not even called replicants. Mm-hmm. There's two other replicants. There's two. There's a whole religion that they've created just for the novel that's not addressed in the movie at all, which explains why everybody's so obsessed with animals in the movie. Sebastian is way different in the novel. It's like, so I was being one of those people that now I can't stand bearing, like, it's not like it was in the book, therefore it's terrible. But then I saw it again a couple of years later, and it's like, I can actually understand why they did that, because that would not have worked in a movie at all.
Well, and again, to what I was saying, they could have made this movie nothing but exposition.
Yeah.
Very easily, and here it expected you to be mildly intelligent, which good on it, because, I mean, frankly, I like Star Wars, but half of that movie is Obi-Wan explaining everything.
Did they have Cyberpunk in 1982? That come along later on?
William Gibson was directly influenced by Blade Runner to write Neuromancer.
Because leaving out nuclear wars or comets or stuff, this could be like the capitalism gone insane future where they pollute too much.
I mean, frankly, I don't even think he thought about it that far, because clearly Deckard doesn't. He has a job to do, and you don't need to explain that world. It's essentially, like I said, a William Friedkin French Connection with robots. You know, I mean, to your point, that's what ruined iRobot for me. Because iRobot is such a simple idea. It's, there are these three rules. Here's how we break them. And to make it this like weird, I mean, it's Will Smith, so now that's associated with bad movies. But at the time, it wasn't.
At the time, I liked iRobot.
Ooh. It's more like the third book, frankly. But it's fine. It's indifferent. They could have done that here, where they're like, my God, there are robots everywhere. I don't trust them, though, because of reasons, and I have an artificial... Like, it could have been any of that.
Is that your Will Smith voice?
Yeah!
Say
wiki, wiki, wow, wow, west.
Say welcome, say welcome to Earth.
Welcome, I think you mean welcome to Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Earth.
So, I saw this with Jeremy on the big screen. Mm-hmm. I don't think he looked away from the screen once. Like, it's just, it's literally beautiful wonder the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, even if not much is going on, and you're appreciative of just incredible filmmaking, visuals, effects, all of that, even if you're like, oh, I don't really care about this scene, I'm just going to look around the frame and just in awe of everything that's going on.
I wonder what inspired them to do that, because the novel, again, it's a lot bleaker and everything's covered in dust.
Well, it's pretty gross. I will say it's probably a little bit of Star Wars, right?
Well, I think the big inspiration is Ridley Scott, by this point, had directed hundreds, if not thousands, of commercials. So this was a man who needed to sell things in a short period of time. And obviously, there's not much room for exposition. So you show everything rather than give it a drawn out.
He was very optimistic, assuming Atari would still be around in 2019.
Yeah, that was upsetting. It's like,
They've announced they're coming out with another system. Yeah. Year.
They almost got everything else right, though. You had
the Jaguar was awesome for its time.
No, it was not.
64-bit thing.
Jaguar was terrible.
With Alien versus Predator.
Oh, that was so bad.
Guys, we can talk about this later. I will say, though,
TurboGrafx 16 was my jam.
I will say, the ads are great, because you were saying, like, it's not Star Trek communism kind of like everyone's the same kind of bullshit. This is like, this is what it's going to look like in the future. Ads are everywhere. It's Neo Tokyo, but the first time since we left an anime in the real world, because now Akira is a thing and Ghost in the Shell was a disaster with Scarlett Johansson. But this is, again, this is 82.
Well, it, that was, I think, the best thing that they did to predict the future, because ads really are everywhere very subtly, and they just sort of blend into the background in this movie the same way that it does in our current lives.
Well, midway through watching this movie, I got frustrated because there was that fetish guy with eyes, and he was like, I can do eyes. And, well, he was vaguely Japanese, so the
Hong,
like a southerner.
The doctor?
Yeah.
In a fur coat?
And then I was thinking about Minority Report, and then I was like, man. And then I realized it was also Philip K. Dick, and I was like, he had an eye fetish. And then I realized that Tom Cruise is doing a Harrison Ford impression throughout that whole movie. And I love me some Spielberg, but it's Spielberg, so there has to be sun. Whereas the rest of Philip K. Dick is just dark and awful.
You know that eye guy was Lo Pan from Big Trouble in Little China, right?
Absolutely. I recognize the character actor right away.
Well, now I do.
And I like how he was plugged into his air conditioning like it was out of Brazil. Again, it's Terry Gilliam. It's everyone in the 80s ripped this movie up. Oh, I loved it so much.
That's what's amazing about this movie is, and Daniel ran through the plot of the movie versus the book, but the movie is very simple. It's very like one episode of an episodic CSI, you know, track these three, four guys down, and that's it. But what this movie does is just creates the world that really fully immerses you. I mean, from all the detail, all the lack of exposition, just it's there. This is the world. We're dropping you into it. We're not going to do wide shots of crowd. It's just you following Harrison Ford around in the streets. The music is all only for this movie, which is like a whole other conversation with Vangelis is just brilliant with the score here. It's just creating this whole world that you definitely hadn't seen before in a film. And the plot, you can just not care about the plot if you want to and still enjoy the movie.
Well, the plot of the book and the basic plot of the book and the movie are identical, so that's not really the issue.
I just mean it's like kind of a simple plot in a very complicated setup, and they decided to forego the setup.
The opening text that tells you everything, you could watch this movie with the sound off and all you would need was that opening crawl and you'd still be able to follow everything and just take in all the visuals.
Well, I mean, there's different cuts that have different opening texts, right?
Well, there are kind of, but like the theatrical version had Harrison Ford giving the narration, which apparently he didn't want to do, so he just sounds drunk the whole time.
Yeah, he does. I've seen that version, and the narration's a disaster.
Well, and whatever. I can't pick the different versions apart because
I'd rent it on Amazon Instant Video. I thought I wouldn't be able to get it in time.
Which version did you watch?
The original cuts. I remember the voiceover about the first 20 minutes or so before I got hold of the
20 minutes.
Yeah, when he's talking about like Edward James Olmos is a brown nose looking for a promotion, and how his boss is like the guy who would use the N word and stuff.
Oh, that's not at all in this movie.
The whole voiceover is gone. So terrible.
Oh man, that's.
I love the fact that you're spending the whole movie, man. Like, what the hell is up with Edward James Olmos? What language is he speaking? What job does he have?
City
who the
speak.
Hell is this guy?
City speak
creepy
is the language.
Cop dude. I mean, it's, that's what he kind of is.
Exactly. And then he's just like, I'm gonna switch to English for the end here and just drop some bombs on you. And you're like, what? Whoa. Who are you?
And it's funny remembering that, like, the conspiracy, whatever you want to call it, the theory that he's a replicant, Deckard's a replicant. The whole time I was looking at almost his character, I'm like, is he a replicant? Is that why he's doing the little origami?
And he's got the weird eyes and speaks other languages. Like,
I love how. I wonder if at one point Harrison Ford was just like, is it my lot in life to be with like little people actors in costumes? Because between the toys and like the people who don't speak to him in English are just like two with noodles.
The Jawa carjacker scene at the end when he's sleeping in his car, the little midgets run up and trying to pull pieces off it.
Yeah.
And they steal his extra tank of gas.
Oh, you want to hear the biggest disaster with the different cuts? Originally, Rachel, his replicant love interest, had no like lifespan. There was no limit to it, which kind of just ruins the whole movie.
Well, and in fact, in one version, they ride off into the sunset together, which I think is the theatrical.
Yeah. It's terrible.
It's stupid. Yeah, I love the vagary. Like, right? Like, being, like, where we don't know what happens.
Yeah.
It's a cut of his life.
But we know she's on the run, she's known to the police, and the police know where she is.
And what's more, like, terrified than being chased by Edward James Olmos the rest of your life?
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
Edward James Olmos,
I mean, teach you a lesson.
He knows that Deckard and Rachel involved in somehow, and he seems like, well, she's not going to live very long, but don't we all? He's like, he doesn't seem to care.
And then it becomes his lot in life to fight robots that look like people, like we saw in Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. It's not a good point. It was a joke, but I appreciate the moral support. I will say, as a movie, we kind of got to talk a little bit about Harrison Ford here. Is this his best movie? It's up there.
Well, in terms of the performance he gives, I don't think so necessarily, because he's meant to be sort of somebody that everybody reacts to rather than anything else. Like, at the final fight, for example, Roy Batty, the main villain's doing all the talking. Harrison Ford doesn't say a word.
I looked right at Jeremy. I said, because, like, they're in that building where Sebastian lived, and once crazy gymnast lady who looks like a Harley Quinn prototype.
Daryl Hannah, I think plays Pris. Yeah.
Once Harley Quinn's prototype dies, he puts his gun away. I'm like, no, it's an 80s movie and Rutger Hauer's still around. You can never holster your gun. Rutger Hauer is around somewhere.
I'm trying to be offensive again. I liked Rutger Hauer better than Harrison Ford in this movie.
That's not really offensive.
That's not offensive.
But you guys are talking about great Harrison Ford. You haven't brought Rutger Hauer yet.
Rutger Hauer's amazing in this movie.
He's perfect.
I mean, he makes a thinking machine into a person.
By the end of this movie,
anyway.
Do you want anything bad to happen to these replicants?
No, they're a bunch of runaway slaves being hunted by a guy who should know better.
Exactly.
That's the whole challenge. This movie is literally about what makes us human, and Deckard is the one who fails.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, they even throw in scenes to make you, to kind of flip it. It's like right around the middle, somewhere a little past the middle of the movie, where he kind of forces himself on Rachel.
Yeah. She saves his life, and he pays her back by semi or outright raping her.
Exactly. It's at that point of the movie you're supposed to be like, oh, the humans are awful.
Well, now we're getting into legalities. Can replicants be raped?
This gets into Battlestar Galactica because they had the whole plot involving that.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
if you don't know if they're human or not. Yeah.
Well, and if Pris, it talks, I'm inclined to think it's human.
Well, and Pris is a pleasure bot for the army, if
yes,
I recall correctly.
Yes, she is.
Like, these are people created to be monsters, and they are not.
And the only person who doesn't treat her like crap is Sebastian. You know, he finds her sleeping in the garbage like she's some homeless person. He takes her home with him.
Well, but that was a trap.
Yeah.
But he didn't
for her
know
or for him?
But, yeah.
For him.
For him.
They were trying to trap him because they wanted to get him.
Sebastian lives, though, right?
Sebastian dies.
Apparently,
Batty kills him.
Batty kills him after Batty kills Tyrell.
We don't see it, but when Harrison Ford is in the car, he gets told that both Tyrell and Sebastian have been killed.
That's right, yes.
That's how to treat a friend.
And that's how he ends up at Sebastian's building.
Yeah.
I'm going to go a little biblical here. You know, what you've done to the least of these, my brethren, also to me. He's the only person, they even say that, he's the only person who's ever treated them with any kindness at all.
Well, and to be fair, they quote the prodigal son twice in that same scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the runaway slaves looking for their father, who's also their god.
That scene is so well done, where they end up in the only thing that isn't covered in filth, which is his beautiful white bedroom, and they're playing chess with those incredible chess sets.
His bedchamber, I think, is based on the Pope's bedchamber, too, so that whole god thing makes sense.
Oh, and with the four-post, it even looks something like Scrooge's in most productions. Like, it's incredible. Like, this movie is well thought out.
Yeah.
who'd have thunk it?
Well, speaking of that whole well-thought-out fan theory, I've never bought into that, first because Deckard is definitively not a replicant in the novel, and they do bring that up. Second, he is so much more pathetic than the replicants. I mean, they're these like supermen basically, and they just beat him up without mercy and with no effort. So it makes no sense.
I mean, he gets nearly the one who's the stripper nearly kills him.
All three of them almost kill him. Pris almost kills him. What's his name? Leon almost kills him.
Yeah.
Wake up, time to die.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, but,
you know, Roy. Someone said, you know, Roy. Batty got the tears in the rain monologue. You know, this is how a real man dies. Even if he's not technically a man. Mm.
The whole thing I thought about those visual cues was the fact that the separation between robots and humans in this universe had become non-existent. Mm-hmm. So it made his job much more horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of why they make sure that they have a four-year lifespan, because otherwise the replicants would last forever, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, as a character, Harrison Ford is running through a basic kind of cop plot, right? I mean, like, yeah. His movie is just, again, it could be a William Friedkin kind of nothing 70s movie. The world is filthy. I'm glad I live in the 20-teens because everything in the 80s movies looks disgusting. Everything. Like, even the 70s.
It's
like,
still time. It's 2019 in this movie.
Right. I laughed out loud in the theater when I said 2019.
Yeah, two more years to end up in rainy, maybe post-apocalyptic Los Angeles.
We're working toward
the way hurricanes are going.
Well, and don't forget, 2 years ago we had Hill Valley from 2015, the future of Back to the Future. So let's not rewrite dystopian novels.
Yeah, and according to T2, Judgment Day already happens.
So. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Don't worry, we've survived them all. We're great.
We're doing just fine.
I love Emmett Walsh being the lumpy boss guy. He's like, look at him.
He shot
people when they said mother.
That's right.
He's sweating. Hey,
he had a really good line, though. Well, he's breathing fine if you don't unplug him.
Poor bastard. He looked like a Cary Elwes. I don't know. But I guess we can talk about the replicants individually. We have Rachel, played by Sean Young, who is all hair. She is the first one that he kind of tests, so we see the full test on, but doesn't get shot.
Oh, the Voight-Kampff test? Well, no. She didn't even know that she was an artificial person. They only proved it after they gave her the test. And in the book, it goes more into it because she's flat out horrified and tries to deny it. But he says something along the lines of, oh, my suitcase, it's made out of baby skin. And she doesn't have an emotional response. And that's how they find out. So by that point, it's like, all right, you're either a psychopath or you're a robot. Which is it, lady?
Can be both.
Well, that's true.
Bender.
I didn't react over much, and you said my suitcase out of baby skin. Probably I know it's all wrong.
He's a sociopath.
Am not.
But she's, I think, the most interesting character overall until we get to Rutger Hauer's final scene, effectively, because she doesn't know she's a replicant. She is a replicant. And so she's literally our in as to we're supposed to question what humanity means in this world.
Well, the best thing about it is that scene where Harrison Ford's reciting her own memories to her because they were implants, and she starts crying as she remembers those implants.
Yeah. And he's drinking a whiskey because it's ruining him, too.
Yeah.
Let's be fair that he's feeling every punch. He's probably has broken ribs and missing teeth as you see him reach into his mouth and he's spitting blood. It's not a sexy scene. None of the... It's the 80s, so nothing is sexy, but...
Hey, some people find it sexy. Everyone's got their thing.
Ronald Reagan mask.
Wait, the 80s weren't sexy? You speak for yourself.
I clearly am. But, I mean, Harrison Ford takes off his shirt not because he's in great shape, but because he's had the ever-loving piss beaten out of him, and he's looking for wounds.
Hey, this was the 80s. People found Burt Reynolds sexy.
He was all mustache and chewing gum.
When she put her hair down, Rachel was pretty, and Daryl Hannah was attractive. She just looks really bizarre in this movie.
I mean, I'm not going to argue that Sean Young is pretty hot. I'm not going
to
do it.
Well, this was before she super glued James Woods' dick to his thigh, so...
That is a true thing that happened.
What movie is that from?
That's not from a movie.
That's something that happened in real life.
Oh, wow.
she glued James's wood to his leg.
Oh, Charlie.
God damn it, Nick.
I'm not wrong.
No, you're not.
James Wood is an asshole, so he can take...
The NSA is about to get a lot of weird Google hits.
You're welcome, Internet. Oh, fuck.
We could talk about one point if you're talking about implanted memories.
Sure.
You know, if you want to keep talking about the movie.
Yeah, that's the basis for the Deckard as a replicant theory, the whole to-do about
the unicorn
memories.
Dream.
The unicorn dream
memory thing.
Because at the end, Edward James almost leaves a unicorn at his door as if to say, I know about you.
I know
exactly. That's what I was trying to get at. Is there more to this than just...
I was wondering why... So he finds a unicorn after he and Rachel are leaving. I thought it made more sense if he finds a unicorn there, flips out, like kicks the door down and finds that Rachel's there all fine. Yeah. Gaff, the whole last line about how she won't live very long, but don't we all? So he knew that there was something going on with Deckard and Rachel.
Right, but like the idea that he was there is the point, right? That he literally knows that she's with him, not that just they were together.
But isn't it more so the point that it's a origami unicorn that he leaves instead of an origami whatever the hell?
I think that's the point, yeah. But he's in his head. And that's why I thought he was a replicant as well.
As we know, the memories that have been implanted in you.
Right.
That makes more sense that he'd be the replicant as opposed to anyone else.
Well, he I mean, the foreign language thing aside, he's always the same. Like, he's very pristine. He appears when he needs to appear. He's almost a plot device.
Well, plus the one thing that I didn't understand, especially considering all the communities in Blade Runner that have sprung up, is why are all the replicants white?
Maybe making them.
I thought he was Asian.
Well, maybe making them other races would have made it the slavery thing too obvious.
I don't think so. I mean, I think the whole idea was that was the ideal Superman still that they were trying to create. But at the same time, that means they wouldn't be able to blend in anywhere if they ever wanted to escape.
It was the 1980s. There were no Asian actors in Hollywood.
Well, except for James Hong, that's who right. was in this movie.
Well, he was the star. They had one. They had to give him a good one.
Okay. Or Pat Morita.
Well, yeah. He showed up and started teaching replicants karate.
That would be the best thing ever.
The 80s explode.
So that's what Blade Runner 2049 is going to be about, right?
Oh my god!
I don't think Pat Morita's still alive and able.
No.
If it worked for Grand Moff Tarkin, it can work for Pat Morita. He can be teaching.
God, Ryan Gosling. That was
terrible. The fact that they did that.
So he can bad. Do. He can teach Ryan Gosling to wax on, wax off after Harrison Ford punches him in the face.
I've seen Ryan Gosling movies. I don't think he has any problem with waxing.
Ew.
Moving on.
Oh. We're just going to let that simmer.
So something about the unicorn and
so Terrell
such.
Is the same guy who played the bartender in The Shining.
Yes, he was.
Nice. Oh, nice pull.
Red rum, red rum.
So he's a figment of the imagination in this movie, too?
I think so. Mm. That makes sense. All right, okay, so we're to it. We might as well talk about... we have two characters that were kind of torn between. We have not William H. Macy, who plays J.F. Sebastian. William Sanderson.
Right.
And we have, on the other hand, we have... What's his name? I almost said Casper Hauer. Rutger Hauer, who plays Roy. Okay, right? These are the two extremes of humanity. They both have short life. One is a murderer. At this point, Roy has killed bunches of people. He's crashed a plane filled with people. He's killed all the people on Mars. And he escaped to try to get away. And we see him kill someone with his thumbnails crushing through the eyes.
Yeah, and then he kills Sebastian. I mean, all the other people you kill, you argue it's him and his replicant buddies trying to escape slavery. But killing Sebastian, that was just a dick move there.
Well, it's so Sebastian can finger them later.
Yeah, but was he going to?
Yeah, why would he have...
First waxing, now fingering. Come on, Daniel. Mind out of the gutter.
Well, I mean, and we have, like, Sebastian, who's this... He's supposed to be 25, but he has the Benjamin Button disease where he's super aging or whatever.
Yeah, he looks like he's 40 at least.
Well, I mean, and that's the point. Like, he instills in people kind of wonder, I guess.
In the book, the whole thing is you can't leave Earth if you have some sort of physical ailment. Like, if you're blind, if stuff like that happens. And in the book, his character's just been so affected by the radioactive dust and everything that he's become, I believe, what they call a chicken head, somebody with a low IQ.
Well, and he mentions that.
Yeah, exactly. He's got, I think they refer to it as Methuselah syndrome or something.
Yeah, there's a story I read in Spanish lit class long ago where it's like, I believe it's called like the Red Stockings or something, where this woman wants to immigrate to Spain's colonies, but her dad beats the crap out of her and blinds her in one eye so she can't because she's now disabled.
That like reminds me of Blade Runner.
So it's like the same thing. They don't want disabled people in their space colonies.
I got nothing.
He's not wrong.
I don't know if Philip K. Dick or really Scott had read that story, but that just reminds
was
me
Philip
of that.
K. Dick in the same Spanish lit class?
I'm saying it is theoretically possible he could have read that story.
How old is the story?
I don't know.
Or he realized that NASA doesn't let people into space with blindness or any physical deficiencies either.
Yeah, but you can't be there's a difference between being an astronaut and being a passenger.
Is there?
If you've got like a space ocean liner going to Mars.
Not when he's writing it in the 1960s, man.
The only human on the planet who could sympathize with the replicants is someone who's been left behind or ostracized or has some kind of issues.
Right.
Because everybody else is a policeman or a... I don't even know.
Or sweating whiskey or...
Some random Japanese cyberpunk
they don't get to be characters.
Well, and again, like that's why Deckard's an interesting character, because everyone else who seems to function normally on the planet has left. Right?
Yeah.
Earth is a terrible place to be. It's awful. It's raining. It's seven. Like, and so the fact that anyone wants to be around, something is wrong with them. We only see bartenders and prostitutes and drunks and sweaty fat people. Right? Except for Terrell in his glorious heavenly mansion. And so when we get to Sebastian, he's an innocent who makes toys. That's it. That's why he's tragic. And he lives in a shitty house for this brilliant man who makes these incredible toys. It's raining. It's awful. It's disgusting.
It's like an, it's like an abandoned apartment building. He's like the a squatter.
Right. And he said there's not enough people to even fill it. There's not even a requirement for space. I can have whatever I want here. Mm-hmm. And it's depressing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he's the saddest character.
And he dies. That's why Roy is a problematic character.
There are good people who do bad things and there are bad people. That would seem to only unambiguously bad thing Roy did was kill the one who had helped them.
Dude, he killed hundreds of people. That's the introduction.
Hundreds? I thought it was just maybe
20
people on a ship.
Well, and I thought they said he killed the hundreds on the mission to get to the ship to then get away and then killed everyone on the ship.
He killed a bunch of people. I know that, but I don't know how it was that many.
And then he killed God, which is generally a bad thing.
Unless you're Trent Reznor, in which case you get an album out of it.
Right. Or Nietzsche, and then you get a greatest hits album.
Yeah, there you go.
But like at the end, he's the one who has the impactful speech. I'm still interested why he doesn't kill Deckard, other than to give John Woo inspiration for everything by releasing a dove as the music flares as he's clearly Christ.
Maybe he wanted to make a point.
He gave himself stigmata.
His point. Well, he had a point. He said his point.
Yeah, what was he doing? It's like his hand was like started not functioning anymore. So
he was dying.
He was shutting down. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. So he was like jump starting himself by shoving a nail into his arm.
He was seeing he could still feel anything because he was slowly losing that ability.
So much more emphasis than I did. I think his hand was just shorting out. So
his hand was crippled because it wasn't working anymore. Like so he shoved a knife or a pin.
It was like a gear that jammed.
He loosened it. And he ended up saving Deckard with that hand later. By the way,
well, I think.
And he kept chasing Deckard not to kill him, but like he said, to make him be in fear for a constant period of time, just like he was as a slave and with a 4-year lifespan. He was constantly in fear.
So teach him a lesson in empathy by inflicting pain.
Yeah, because he knows he's dying. Okay, so what's the point in killing him right now? Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's so interesting because Roy has had no problem killing people before this. So it's kind of interesting that he literally learns humanity in the last 10 seconds.
Killing Deckard at that point would just been spiteful. There's no way he can save his own life. There's no way he can save the lives of his friends. Why?
So does that mean it doesn't matter?
Well, they're saying the only reason Roy would have to kill Deckard at that point was just be pure spite, not for any purpose.
Right. So does that mean it doesn't matter?
No, he's saying that's a good thing, that it reflects well on Roy.
Okay, I guess. But just saying I'm too tired.
Well, I think you're right. Like, the second he noticed he was, like, this is it. Like, he kept saying, not yet. Like, his hands are starting to crumble up. He knows he's dying. It's almost like it all hit him at once. Like, oh, humans are aware of this shit all the time.
Yeah.
And it all just hit him what dying means.
Well, I mean, and that's what I was trying to get you to.
Right.
Like, because, like, the whole thing is by saving him, this sticks with Deckard forever. This is his memory transferring on. And that's what he said. These eyes have seen burning of galaxies and destruction and death and horrible things and beautiful things. And the second I power down, that's all erased forever. By telling this to you, you're going to remember it. So I live forever.
Right.
That's all it's saying. Like, he is transferring humanity on in a moment that could otherwise literally not matter at all, right?
And that's probably why he makes the decision to run away with Rachel.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Humanity survives.
Yeah, that gets another thing. Does a thinking machine at that level have a soul? Because in Alien Resurrection, the Annalie Call's character is an android. He's also a Catholic. In the novelization, they go into this whole thing about what happens when I die.
We just brought Alien Resurrection into a discussion of Blade Runner.
Nailed the last like 15 minutes of this movie as a group. That was awesome.
Alien Resurrection. And you brought up the novelization, which came after the fact.
Well, I mean,
that's the trailer for your books.
Yeah, but
that's something else.
But you get into Tears in the Rain, Time to Die. Like, he doesn't think he's going to have an afterlife. He just thinks he's going to end.
Well, because he is. He's a machine.
But he's figured out how you pass things on.
Right, exactly.
That you as an individual maybe don't matter as much as passing things on.
I'll go further. I don't think there's a God in this universe. Really, I don't. Like, there's nothing to say that there's hope for anything. There's no future. Right? It just seems like people are surviving. These robots are the only things that seem to matter. And they're literally used to mine to keep what's a dead Earth surviving.
Or prepare the way to prepare new Earths, like a golden land and a new beginning.
But that's not what they're saying. They're mining those places dry, it sounds like.
Yeah.
That's why they can't use humans, because it's come too dangerous for humans to even be there. It's awful, right? Well,
plus, in terms of that, they also killed God.
They literally
robots
killed
said they
Terrell.
Kill God.
They killed their own God. Anyway, we've talked long enough. We could talk forever. This is literally a film class.
This is what happens when you watch a good movie. Like, you can actually go off in like these kind of intelligent discussions instead of, Doubtfire.
Yeah, I need to.
I'll need to go blog about this some more so I can get more and stuff about God.
Are you gonna write a fan script too?
No, this is. It was boring a lot of times. It was a good, well done movie. I can't make a Blade Runner reboot. No.
Well, I mean, they're doing it in 6 weeks. Although, actually, I asked Jeremy, and we'll get to, we should talk about this now before we give our final conclusions. Are you guys optimistic for the sequel?
Does it need to have a sequel? That's the one thing I get. I mean, as a standalone thing in the same universe, it could be interesting. But
you don't make a sequel 35 years after the original unless you have something to say.
Well, it looks nice. Yeah.
And a really good director.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true.
Well, I mean, I was going to be down on it too, but I think Jeremy convinced me, like, because he didn't need to make this movie. There wasn't a huge demand to make a sequel. He didn't have to. Mm-hmm. So he must have a script.
I read, I think it might have been from the Tribune, that he originally turned it down until they showed him the script. It's like, oh, that's actually decent. Yeah, I'll do it.
And I am there to watch Ryan Gosling get punched in the face.
Mm-hmm.
I'm there to see old Harrison Ford choose a role he wants to be in. The only other role I want to see him in, and I told this to Jeremy, after Olympus Has Fallen and London Has Fallen, they're making a third movie called Angel Has Fallen, which is about Air Force One. He should be the old president that they call in for advice as a kind of unofficial sequel to Air Force One, yes. Man. That'd be
awesome. I would watch the hell out of that movie.
Episode of Air Force One.
I want to see Witness 2, where he's taken up the Amish lifestyle for 40 years and then he gets
welcome
pulled.
To Rumspringa, bitch.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh man, he has to go find a kid who never came back. Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Alright, I will just go around the table backwards. Scott?
I've always really liked this movie. I haven't seen, the theatrical version, or I think I've seen the director's cut and the final cut, but this movie always just amazes me, just in the way it was made, all the effects, the music, the atmosphere, the beautiful framing, the characters. It's just, I think, a very interesting, really good sci-fi film that definitely holds up, even though we're getting close to the year that it says it's in, but I don't think that matters. I think it really holds up, and I'm glad we talked about it.
I don't feel like I can really add anything to what we've already discussed. It's a good movie, and you should go see it.
Matt?
Yeah. It wasn't as entertaining as I'd like it to be, but it does explore some interesting philosophical questions. Like Jeremy brought up Battlestar Galactica and whether or not a machine is a person or not. And believe me, I got into a bunch of online arguments about that very issue. And it's a very interesting world that maybe more stories could be set in it, but which brothers are doing in a few weeks. So yeah, go see it. Don't expect it necessarily a slam bang action fest, but I think it's well done.
Mm-hmm. Jerry?
Yeah, impeccably designed. You can see its influence in pretty much everything that came after it. I guess my only wish was I wish I could have been there in 1982 to have seen it, like almost the same way in that, when Star Wars came out in 77, it was like unlike anything people had ever seen. I wish I could have gotten that full experience too, because, you see bits and pieces and everything, but to have been able to be there when it came out and see it for the first time, that would have been insane. But even today, after all that's come through it, it's still an original. It's still compelling, and yeah, definitely see it.
Thank you, Jeremy. I mean, actually, to build off of him, I love this movie. I first saw it with Mark, regular panelist Mark, whatever version was out in the mid-90s, probably the director's cut. It's almost hard to watch it because you'll hate other movies, man. Like, even looking at Dark Knight, like, you know, the Chris Nolan's world is almost this world. Like, it's just so incredibly influential in a way that there must have only been film people in the audience for something that bombed. Like, the miniature work is incredible. To see the real car lift off the ground, right? Yeah. To see, like, the car then fly around this incredibly futuristic city is just, it's breathtaking. It does occasionally kind of slide into the art film where it doesn't have any dialogue. I mean, Harrison Ford's script must be 30 pages and the rest of it is him just grunting and walking around and empty. Like, but I'm okay with that. Sometimes you have to make a movie worthwhile, and it's definitely worth that effort. You know, it definitely is. Tune in next week. I forgot to do the thing I do. So before we go, I have my hint for next episode. It's a sequel to a movie we've already done, and Matt name-checked it without thinking at the beginning of this episode.
Ooh.
So tune in next week and every future week when I put another piece of your past on trial. Thanks, guys.
Myopia Defender Childhood is a member of the ESO Network and produced by Dude Letter Podcasting. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman. It is edited by Nick Hoffman and Candace Burns. The theme song is Caroline by the Serenaders, and their music is available on Amazon. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. And tune in next week when we put another little piece of your past on trial. Thanks!